listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Welcome to another episode. This is your host, Shane Vanderhart. I apologize for the extended absence. I hope now that we are headed into September, coming up on 1 year of doing this podcast, those absences will become less frequent. There are several things on my agenda today. First, the New York Times publishes an anonymous opinion piece from a member of the resistance who identifies as part of the White House, part of the Trump administration. This is on the heels of the Washington Post providing a preview of Bob Woodward's book on the Trump administration entitled Fear. President Trump is obviously not pleased. Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing started this week, and as you would expect, it's been an absolute circus. I want to highlight some of the more important moments. Then I also speak with Mary Hassan, who's co-author of Get Out Now, Why You Should Pull Your Child from Public School Before It's Too Late. She co-wrote that with Teresa Farman. Before we get to that, first, a word from our sponsor.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
The New York Times makes the rare move of publishing an anonymous opinion piece. Anonymous sources are normal. I'm not a fan of them, but I understand why people don't go on the record on occasion, especially if they're within the Trump administration or any White House administration, really. It's unusual for any newspaper to run a piece without a name attached, however, and yet the New York Times did. Introducing the piece, they wrote, quote, "The Times today is taking the rare step of publishing an anonymous op-ed essay. We have done so at the request of the author, a senior official in the Trump administration, whose identity is known to us and whose job would be jeopardized by its disclosure. We believe publishing this essay anonymously is the only way to deliver an important perspective to our readers." Unquote. Our history is full of examples of anonymous news pieces. The Federalist Papers, for instance, written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay, were initially published anonymously. Benjamin Franklin published works under a pseudonym. And we have many columnists over the years that published anonymously or under a pseudonym. This is unique, however, because it's being lent credibility by the New York Times. They say this is a senior official in the Trump administration. There is the obvious question of who is this person, in what capacity do they serve, just how senior are they? I've heard speculation that the piece was written by Vice President Pence to down to a narcissistic White House summer intern. I think we're safe to assume it's probably somewhere in between those two extremes. Anonymous writes, quote, "President Trump is facing a test to his presidency, unlike any faced by a modern American leader. It's not just that the special counsel looms large, or that the country is bitterly divided over Mr. Trump's leadership, or even that his party might well lose the House to an opposition hell-bent on his downfall. The dilemma, which he does not fully grasp, is that many of the senior officials in his own administration are working diligently from within to frustrate parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations. I would know. I am one of them. To be clear, ours is not the popular resistance of the left. We want the administration to succeed and think that many of its policies have already made America safer and more prosperous. But we believe that it is our duty to this country and the president, and the president continues to act in a manner that is detrimental to the health of our republic. That is why many Trump appointees have vowed to do what we can to preserve our democratic institutions while thwarting Mr. Trump's more misguided impulses until he is out of office," unquote. That gives us a clue that he's an appointee and not necessarily a career White House or a career White House official or executive branch employee. But what he wrote here begs the question, exactly how are they frustrating the agenda? Who are these appointed officials? How many are there? And is this an embellishment? Are they being subversive or are they just advocating for sound policy? I hope the president's hearing a bevy of ideas. I don't think it's a big secret that some of his administration have been a check on President Trump. There's a reason why his policy agenda, which from my perspective has been mostly good, is vastly different than what we see in his Twitter feed. I don't want members, however, being subversive or devious. It's one thing to advocate sound policy, but it's another to subvert the authority of the president in an underhanded way. Anonymous continues, quote, "The root of the problem is the president's amorality. Anyone who works with him knows he is not moored to any discernible first principles that guide his decision-making. Although he was elected as a Republican, the president shows little affinity for ideals long espoused by conservatives, free minds, free markets, and free people. At best, he has invoked these ideals in scripted settings. At worst, he has attacked them outright. In addition to his mass marketing of the notion that the press is the enemy of the people, President Trump's impulses are generally anti-trade and anti-democratic. Don't get me wrong, there are bright spots that the near ceaseless negative coverage of the administration fails to capture. Effective deregulation, historic tax reform, a more robust military, and more. But these successes have come despite, not because of, the president's leadership style, which is impetuous, adversarial, petty, and ineffective," unquote. Well, no, these successes did not happen in spite of President Trump's leadership. Had he not been elected, then much of what we have seen in policy would not have come to pass. He is the one who made the appointments, including possibly the person writing this piece. Without Trump, tax cuts, rolling back on the Obama executive orders, religious liberty protection, you name it, would not be possible. These things certainly would not have happened in a Hillary Clinton White House. Honestly, there is nothing in this letter that has not already been assumed. But Anonymous continues, quote, "From the White House to executive branch departments and agencies, senior officials will privately admit their daily disbelief at the commander-in-chief's comments and actions. Most are working to insulate their operations from his whims. Meetings with him veer off topic and off the rails. He engages in repetitive rants, and his impulsiveness results in half-baked, ill-informed, and occasionally reckless decisions that have to be walked back. There is literally no telling where he might change his mind from one minute to the next," a top official complained to me recently, exasperated by the Oval Office meeting at which the president flip-flopped on a major policy decision he'd made only a week earlier. "The erratic behavior would be more concerning if it weren't for unsung heroes in and around the White House. Some of his aides have been cast as villains by the media, but in private they have gone to great lengths to keep bad decisions contained to the West Wing, though they are clearly not always successful. It may be cold comfort in this chaotic era, but Americans should know that there are adults in the room. We fully recognize what is happening, and we are trying to do what's right when Donald Trump won't. The result is a two-track presidency. Take foreign policy. In public and in private, President Trump shows a preference for autocrats and dictators such as President Vladimir Putin of Russia and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, and displays little genuine appreciation for the ties that bind us into the allied like-minded nations. Astute observers have noted, though, that the rest of the administration is operating on another track, one where countries like Russia are called out for meddling and punished accordingly, and where allies around the world are engaged as peers rather than ridiculed as rivals. On Russia, for instance, the president was reluctant to expel so many of Mr. Putin's spies as punishment for the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Britain. He complained for weeks about senior staff members letting him get boxed into further confrontation with Russia, and he expressed frustration that the United States continued to impose sanctions on the country for its malign behavior. But his national security team knew better. Such actions had to be taken to hold Moscow accountable. This isn't the work of a so-called deep state. It's the work of the steady state, unquote. You know, none of this is new criticism. Frankly, are we to believe that policy has been implemented without the president's approval? Yeah, he may have drug his feet. Yeah, he may not have liked it initially, but eventually he was talked into it. Again, that is how the cabinet should work. They are his advisors. He's supposed to bring people around him that are experts who can give him all sides and hopefully talk him out of bad policy decisions. Anonymous continues, quote, given the instability many witnessed, there were early whispers within the cabinet of invoking the 25th Amendment, which would start a complex process for removing the president, but no one wanted to precipitate a constitutional crisis. So we will do what we can to steer the administration in the right direction until, one way or another, it's over, unquote. You know, look, if President Trump is truly unstable, then his cabinet is duty-bound to invoke the 25th Amendment. The process Anonymous is describing here is unconstitutional, unless, of course, it's being overstated, which I think that's the case. But, however, invoking the 25th would be a constitutional grounds for removing the president, should they be able to prove that he's unfit for office. And when I say unfit, I don't mean policies you disagree with. I mean mentally unstable or physically unable to carry out the work of the presidency. Beyond undermining the president and making him look bad, what does this article actually accomplish? If there are elements within the Trump administration who are trying to steer President Trump away from bad policy, this letter just made their job all that much harder. The author is not doing his cause any good. Now, President Trump, understandably, will attempt to root out these people out of his administration. This will now distract the president from the work he should be focusing on. If this person had any integrity at all, he or she would have resigned and authored this in their own name so that we could judge what is said in this piece with full information. The article's timing is also suspect since it comes on the heels of the Washington Post's preview of Bob Woodward's book on the Trump administration entitled Fear. These are two pieces that certainly paint a narrative. Bob Woodward has had a distinguished career with the Washington Post. He does have the habit of late to report what is essentially hearsay as fact, and that's problematic in my view. Supposedly, he has tapes to back up a lot of what he writes in his book, and if that's the case, then good, and I hope eventually he will release those tapes. But looking in this article, Robert Costa for the Washington Post writes, quote, a central theme of the book is the steady machinations used by those in Trump's inner sanctum to try to control his impulses and prevent disasters, both for the president personally and for the nation he was elected to lead. Woodward describes an administrative coup d'etat and a nervous breakdown of the executive branch, with senior aides conspiring to pluck official papers from the president's desk so he couldn't see or sign them. Again and again, Woodward recounts at length how Trump's national security team was shaken by his lack of curiosity and knowledge about world affairs and his contempt for the mainstream perspectives of military and intelligence leaders. At the National Security Council meeting on January 19th, Trump disregarded the significance of a massive U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula, including a special intelligence operation unit that allows the United States to detect a North Korean missile launch in 7 seconds versus 15 minutes from Alaska, according to Woodward. Trump questioned why the government was spending resources in the region at all. We are doing this in order to prevent World War III, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told him. After Trump left the meeting, Woodward recounts, Mattis was particularly exasperated and alarmed, telling close associates that the president acted like and had the understanding of a fifth or sixth grader. In Woodward's telling, many top advisors were repeatedly unnerved by President Trump's actions and expressed dim views of him. Secretaries of Defense don't always get to choose the president they work for, Mattis told friends at one point, prompting laughter as he explained Trump's tendency to go off on tangents about subjects such as immigration and the news media, unquote. Now, I have serious doubts that Secretary Mattis would speak like this to anyone with whom he did not absolutely trust. The former Marine General understands the chain of command, and it is uncharacteristic of military officers to speak out of turn like this. That's not to say they always have a high opinion of those they serve under. I know that's not true. But they generally don't disparage them to others, especially subordinates. Mattis has denied saying anything disparaging, as has President Trump's chief of staff, former General John Kelly, who was also named in the book. Costa continues, quote, White House chief of staff John F. Kelly frequently lost his temper and told colleagues that he thought the president was, quote-unquote, unhinged, Woodward writes. In one small group meeting, Kelly said of Trump, he's an idiot. It's pointless to try to convince him of anything. He's gone off the rails. We're in crazy town. I don't even know why any of us are here. This is the worst job I've ever had, unquote. Now, some of what is described in the Washpo article's account of Woodward's book are things I was concerned about prior to President Trump's election. He has a tendency to have one-track mind when it comes to certain things that get under his skin. I can certainly see him interrupting, going off on tangents. None of that is necessarily surprising to me. But I just don't picture General Kelly speaking this way about President Trump. And frankly, if it's the worst job someone has ever had, then quit. Then quit. There's no reason to stay in the administration if you absolutely hate the job. If you hate yourself for doing the job, why in the world would you want to stay there? I know I wouldn't. It's not like he wouldn't have other job opportunities should he resign. Now, there are accounts of President Trump belittling staff members. Quote, Trump apparently had little regard for Priebus. He once introduced the then staff secretary Rob Porter to ignore Priebus, even though Porter reported the chief of staff saying that Priebus was like a little rat. He just scurries around. Few in Trump's orbit were protected from the president's insults. He often mocked the National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster's behind the back, puffing up his chest and exaggerating his breathing as he impersonated the retired Army general, and once said McMaster dresses in cheap suits like a beer salesman. Trump told Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, a wealthy investor 8 years his senior, I don't trust you. I don't want you doing any more negotiations. You're past your prime, unquote. Now, some of this is believable to me because I've seen and heard what he said about members of his cabinet publicly. I can only imagine what he says in private. So some of what was written, however, I find just completely implausible. Costa writes, quote, Cohen, a Wall Street veteran, tried to tamp down Trump's strident nationalism, this is Gary Cohen, regarding trade. According to Woodward, Cohen stole a letter off Trump's desk that the president was intending to sign to formally withdraw the United States from a trade agreement with South Korea. Cohen later told an associate that he removed the letter to protect national security and that Trump did not notice it was missing, unquote. Okay, President Trump may not have noticed the document was missing, but I'm sure whoever put it on his desk to sign certainly had to notice. You know, this could not have possibly gone unnoticed. And frankly, the thought of somebody pulling off a document like this on his desk, a trade agreement, I mean, it's just appalling. So it's certainly not something someone would brag about. Frankly, it's probably illegal to do something like that. I don't know the federal law in that instance, but I can't imagine it's kosher to do. Certainly a fireable offense, if not, if it doesn't open that person up to any more legal problems. As with all tell-alls like this, there are probably elements of truth, but also embellishment. We don't know how many sources Woodward spoke with and what their motivations are. I kind of, reading through Costa's article in the Washington Post, I kind of sensed, at least with the things that he was talking about, probably one, maybe two sources. That's just, from my perspective, it seemed like this was coming from one or two people. We don't know who those people are. We don't know what their motivations are. Releasing tapes would certainly dispel some of the mystery. I'm not going to hold my breath that's going to happen anytime soon. And as you can imagine, President Trump is not taking this well. He's called on the New York Times to release, for instance, the name of the author of the anonymous article, saying, you know, it's for national security reasons they should give him up. He didn't reveal any state secrets in his article, so I just don't see that. He's also invoked treason for people involved, you know, talking with Bob Woodward. You know, none of these are the case. He's just embarrassed. And as we've seen with most stories like this, the left will believe it all, and President Trump's supporters will believe none of it. Unless tapes are released, I don't see this making much of an impact at all down the road. On to the Kavanaugh hearing. The Senate Judiciary Committee's confirmation hearing for Judge Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court has been an absolute circus. There were 44 disruptions on the first day. Capitol Police arrested 70 protesters. Senate Democrats have been, in my opinion, incorrigible. A bright spot was Senator Ben Sass of Nebraska, who gave a civics lesson during his opening statement. We've already highlighted that on Caffeinated Thoughts, so I don't want to go say too much about it, but here's a clip.
Well, it's pretty obvious to most people going about their work today that the deranged comments actually don't have anything to do with you. So we should figure out, why do we talk like this about Supreme Court nominations now? There's a bunch that's atypical in the last 19, 20 months in America. Senator Klobuchar's right. The comments from the White House yesterday about trying to politicize the Department of Justice, they were wrong and they should be condemned. And my guess is Brett Kavanaugh would condemn them. But really, the reason these hearings don't work is not because of Donald Trump. It's not because of anything the last 20 months. These confirmation hearings haven't worked for 31 years in America. People are going to pretend that Americans have no historical memory, and supposedly there haven't been screaming protesters saying women are going to die at every hearing for decades. But this has been happening since Robert Bork. This is a 31-year tradition. There's nothing really new the last 18 months. So the fact that the hysteria has nothing to do with you means that we should ask, what's the hysteria coming from? The hysteria around Supreme Court confirmation hearings is coming from the fact that we have a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the Supreme Court in American life now. Our political commentary talks about the Supreme Court like there are people wearing red and blue jerseys. That's a really dangerous thing. And by the way, if they have red and blue jerseys, I would welcome my colleagues to introduce the legislation that ends lifetime tenure for the judiciary. Because if they're just politicians, then the people should have power and they shouldn't have lifetime appointments. So until you introduce that legislation, I don't believe you really want the Supreme Court to be a politicized body, though that's the way we constantly talk about it now.
Senator Sass is right. We don't want a politicized court. We do want a originalist court, at least I do, and most conservatives do, who will interpret the Constitution and laws on the basis of the text of the Constitution and laws, as well as the context. Not run the Constitution through the prevailing thought of today and interpret it to mean whatever they need it to mean at the time. Sass is right. Also, the confirmation hearing process is broken, and senators like him need to remind Americans what they are trying to accomplish. Judge Kavanaugh also had some encouraging remarks during his statement.
For 12 years, I've been a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. I have written more than 300 opinions and handled more than 2,000 cases. I have given it my all in every case. I am proud of that body of work, and I stand behind it. I tell people, don't read about my judicial opinions, read the opinions. I have served with 17 other judges, each of them a colleague and a friend, on a court now led by our superb Chief Judge, Merrick Garland. My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, A judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and...
Today, U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, a Democrat, decided to ignore Senate rules and release a document that was classified committee confidential. He had an interesting exchange with Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa and later U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas.
Instead, what I'm releasing this document right now to show, sir, is that we have a process here for a person, the highest office in the land, for a lifetime appointment. We're rushing through this before me and my colleagues can even read and digest the information.
Can I ask you how long you're going to say the same thing three or four times?
No, sir. How long do you want to take? I'm knowingly violating the rules.
Okay.
Senator Cornyn has called me out for it.
How many times you learn to tell us,
sir? I'm saying right now that I'm releasing committee confidential documents.
Mr. Chairman, since the senator invoked my name, I insist on an opportunity to respond.
I did not mention
his name.
Okay.
But he had mentioned my name, and he's right. Running for president is no excuse for violating the rules of the Senate or of the confidentiality of the documents that we are privy to. This is no different from the senator deciding to release classified information that is deemed classified by the executive branch because you happen to disagree with the classification decision. That is irresponsible and outrageous, and I hope that the senator will reconsider his decision, because no senator deserves to sit on this committee or serve in the Senate, in my view, if they decide to be a law unto themselves and willingly flout the rules of the Senate and the determination of confidentiality and classification. That is irresponsible and conduct unbecoming a senator.
U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a Republican, on Wednesday rebuked Democrats who said they would not vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh.
And I'm here to tell anybody in the country who listens that this is so hypocritical of my friends on the other side. When it was their president, Kavanaugh was right. When you're talking about Roe v. Wade, it's okay to promise the nation it will never be overturned. It's okay to pick a Democratic staff member of this committee, but it's not okay to pick somebody who's been a lifelong Republican. People see through this. You had a chance and you lost. If you want to pick judges from your way of thinking, then you better win an election. I voted for two of your choices, Sotomayor and Kagan. Got a lot of crap. I would suggest you think long and hard if you got a political ambition of voting for this guy, because it will not play well on your side. And why did I do it? I thought they were qualified by any reasonable measure given the history of the Senate. But we have turned the history of the Senate upside down.
Senator Graham is right. Elections do have consequences. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, also a Republican, pointed out the Democrats lack substantive criticism.
Third, it's important to understand today is also not about documents. We've heard a lot of arguments this morning about documents. There's an old saying for trial lawyers: if you have the facts, pound the facts. If you have the law, pound the law. If you have neither, pound the table. We're seeing a lot of table pounding this morning. The Democrats are focused on procedural issues because they don't have substantive points strong enough to derail this nomination. They don't have substantive criticism with Judge Kavanaugh's actual judicial record, so they're trying to divert everyone with procedural issues. But let's talk about the documents for a moment. The claims that the Democrats are putting forward on documents don't withstand any serious scrutiny. Judge Kavanaugh has produced 511,948 pages of documents. That includes more than 17,000 pages in direct response to this committee's written questionnaire, which is the most comprehensive response ever submitted to this committee. The more than a half million pages of documents turned into this committee is more than the number of pages we've received for the last five Supreme Court nominees combined. Listen to that fact again. The over a half million documents turned over to this committee is more than the last five nominees submitted to this committee combined. So what's all the fuss?
What is all the fuss indeed? Democrats also complained they didn't have enough time to read all the documents that Senator Cruz discussed. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa addressed those concerns.
But not all of these presidential records remain confidential. In fact, nearly two-thirds already became public. These records are posted on the committee's public website and available to the American people. As a result, we provided unprecedented public access to a record number of presidential records and did it in record time. The most sensitive presidential records remain committee confidential under federal law, just as they were during the nominations of Kagan or Gorsuch. But we have expanded access to these documents also. Instead of just providing access to committee members, we provided access to all 100 senators. Instead of just providing access to a very few committee aides, we provided access to all committee aides. And instead of just providing access to physical binders of paper, we provided 24/7 digital and searchable access. This is unprecedented access to committee confidential material. I'd also like to add that my staff set up workstations and have been available 24/7 to help senators who are not on committee access confidential materials, but not one senator showed up. I guess senators complaining about lack of access to confidential documents weren't really interested in seeing them in the first place. But I want to emphasize more documents are widely available than in any prior Supreme Court nomination.
The simple fact is this: Democrats were going to oppose whomever President Trump appointed. Judge Brett Kavanaugh was a safe choice by Trump. He was liked not only by the Federalist Society, but he was liked within the Beltway establishment. He was liked within the legal establishment. He has a lot of people going to bat for him on both sides of the aisle, not necessarily in the Senate, outside the Senate. He has a compelling history, a compelling story, a pretty in-depth record, judicial record. He's been on the bench for a while. He was also, pretty much, I think he was confirmed unanimously when he was first confirmed to the circuit court. So he's got that as well. You know, if Democrats will not vote to confirm him, I think it's safe to say they're not going to vote to confirm anybody who they think is an originalist. Also, all this is for naught. Barring some unexpected development, Kavanaugh will be confirmed. If Democrats don't like it, then they should thank former Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada, who nuked the filibuster for judicial appointments when the Democrats were in the majority. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to say about the confirmation hearing, but I'm moving along to my discussion with Mary Hassan, who is the co-author of Get Out Now, Why You Should Pull Your Child from Public School Before It's Too Late, co-written with Teresa Farman. Hassan is the director of the Catholic Women's Forum, as well as a fellow with the Catholic Studies Program within the Ethics and Public Policy Center located in Washington, D.C. I started reading her book last weekend. My wife and I homeschooled all of our kids all the way through, and in that time, I have never actively advocated parents pull their kids out of public school. My advice to parents has always been, when I was a youth pastor, as well as when I've written on education policy, to just be engaged with their child's education, whether it's public school, private school, or homeschooling. parents have to be involved. Parental involvement is the, I think, the number one factor, number one indicator of whether a child is going to be successful academically or not. I think that's still true, regardless of what educational setting a parent finds himself in and their child in. But you know, high school and public school, is not the same as when I was a kid. It frankly wasn't even the same 10 years ago. It's changed that much over the last few years. And Hassan and Furman make an excellent argument why, for the sake of your children, it's time to get out. Here's my conversation with Mary Hassan. I am with Mary Hassan, who's co-author of Get Out Now, Why You Should Pull Your Child from Public School Before It's Too Late, written with Teresa Farman. Mary, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So the title of your book, I'm a homeschooling dad. We homeschooled all three of our children all the way through. My last child just graduated high school. But when I saw the title of your book, I'm like, that's provocative.
It's not wishy-washy. Let's put it that way.
Right. So what kind of response have you been getting?
Actually, a very good response. People want to know, why is this such an imperative? Why is it so important, and why now? And that leads into the main point we're making, is that whatever people remember about the public schools, whatever their own experiences were for themselves or even for their older children, it is a radically different ballgame today. And because of changes, particularly in the past few years regarding the whole transgender agenda.
Okay, so how long have you been considering writing this? And was there a particular event that just pushed you and Teresa to say, hey, yeah, we have to sound the alarm. We can't not write this book.
Well, you know, both of us have had a keen interest in education and follow education trends, and have worked in education, particularly for the Catholic Church, just being on advisory boards and different things. So it's been something that we've followed as a matter of policy. And then one of the things that was tremendously disturbing was during the Obama administration, just seeing the push for the transgender agenda just being accelerated in a way that cut parents out of the equation and kept parents in the dark. So not even just a matter of can you control this or exempt your kids or opt them out or whatever, but parents not even being told what's going on. And so we started digging into that, and it just became for us the news that we wanted to get out. The problems with the public schools are sort of longstanding, and people can say, yeah, but I know my principal, I know my teacher, I know my school board. But the point that we're trying to make in the book, and even for those who think I'm never going to pull my kid out of public school, we say, read this and educate yourself, because it is not what you think.
Okay, well, you going back to the Obama administration, you're referring to the Dear Colleague letter sent out with Title IX?
Yes, that in particular, because it put the weight of the administration and the threat of legal action on educational institutions to really buy into and go along with the whole gender identity thing. And it really distorted the priorities where instead of looking for ways to make sure that everyone's safe and everyone's included and accommodated, the exception became the norm. So it just reversed things, where there was no longer any concern about the privacy, for example, of ordinary girls who then would be subject to having a biological boy intruding on all their private spaces, not just bathrooms. You know, we hear a lot about bathrooms, but locker rooms, right, overnight accommodations when they take a field trip or a sports team travels or things, and that parents would not have the right to know if their daughter, for example, was being roomed with a transgender girl, which means a biological boy. Right. So the Obama administration, that crystallized a lot of things, and it drew a lot of public attention. But really what we saw, because the Obama administration was so closely tied to so many of the advocacy groups, and in particular, the LGBT special interest groups, we saw a real flood of this kind of content coming into the public schools in the form of anti-bullying programs, mm-hmm. in the form of the teacher training that teachers were being given, the pressure groups from the outside, and also the threat of litigation. So it became something, all this flourished under the Obama administration, but it would be a mistake to say, well, it all stems from that Dear Colleague letter, and now the Obama, or now the Trump administration withdrew that, so therefore there's no problem, because that's just not true.
Oh, so it didn't fix it.
It did not fix it. What it did was it just kind of removed an irritant. It removed a pressure point. But what we've seen is that the same advocacy groups, the same special interest groups, the same people who are pushing the agenda, mm-hmm. shifted their tactics from the federal level to the state level and the local level, from school boards to human rights commissions to state education legislation and things like that. So right, the problem is there.
Yeah, you write quite a bit about what happened in Minnesota, and if I recall, I mean, a lot of that started way long before the Dear Colleague letter. So,
correct. And one of the things to notice about the case that we open with, you know, talking about this situation in a Minnesota charter school, is that parents sometimes think, wait a minute, my kid goes to a charter school, so that's different. And what? Yeah, you know, they're still public schools, and right. they still have to kind of kowtow to whatever the prevailing pressures are within the public education system. And so and they are susceptible to litigation. That's just become a real tactic, where Lambda Legal has made it known they will sue any school district that they need to in order to force transgender inclusion, which, again, that's not what they define that in a way that would not, most parents would not recognize. It's not about being nice and making someone not feel left out. It's about forcing everyone to normalize and to buy into and to conform to, and even to speak words you don't believe in order to validate the whole transgender agenda.
Right. Well, and that's even being done in schools that don't actually have transgender students, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Right. It doesn't. That was one of the ironies, frankly, mm-hmm. of that Minnesota case. The family that started this with a complaint had a son who was identifying as a girl, but they ended up pulling their child from the charter school. And yet the settlement that the charter school ended up making to avoid future litigation and penalties and things applies to every single person in that school community, even though there's no longer a child who has a confused gender identity in that school. And the other thing parents need to realize is it's not just transgender, even though we use that shorthand, the transgender agenda. Mm-hmm. Now it's increasingly where the schools are looking to promote the idea that everyone is really kind of non-binary, that you just, we're all fluid and we all can choose. And it's frightening.
I wrote on social media when I was reading your book, at that point, I said, we live in stupid times. it's just mind-blowing what our kids are and parents and administrators and teachers are expected to embrace that actually, mm-hmm. You know, denies science. I mean,
denies science. Exactly. Exactly. And what's ironic to me, too, is that about the same time that the Obama administration was pushing all this stuff in terms of education policy, the NIH came out with a protocol that all the clinical trials need to designate whether the participants, the subjects, are either male or female biologically. Why? Because sex is in every cell of the body, and it affects the outcome of clinical trials to know whether the person who is the subject of the clinical trial is male or female. Gender identity doesn't matter. Right. Sex is what counts.
Yeah, absolutely. You made a great point too in your book when you you mentioned, even as you, even if you transition and you identify as a, you know, if you're a transgender male who's female, I'm going to get myself confused. if you're really a female and you decide you're male or vice versa, throughout the rest of your life, when you're doing medical screening, you have to constantly talk about your biological sex, or you're going to end up, you know, possibly being misdiagnosed or have the, you know, wrong course of treatment as a result. You guys write in your book that, I think it was in the introduction, the truth is that nearly everything in America's public schools, the culture, discipline, curriculum, hiring practices, school policies, even the names of the schools themselves, which I thought was interesting, is determined by progressive ideologues, both inside and outside the school system. How did we get to that point?
I think it's the proverbial frog in the water and the temperature turning up and people not realizing how significant seemingly small changes are. And so there are a couple of things. As the country has swung more to the progressive end, that has influenced the ability or increased the influence of these outside organizations. And I apologize here. There is a siren in the background, so I don't know if you want to pause for a second.
Oh, no, it's fine. The thing with recording at home, sometimes I'll have a dog bark or, you know, things like that. Just the dangers of doing a podcast, so no worries. I could barely hear it anyway.
Okay. All right. So a number of things have changed, and one of them is that America's schools have become detached from the parents who send their children there, from the communities in which those schools are located, so that the driving influence is really coming from outside in terms of all the professional education establishment associations, the National School Counselors, not just the teachers unions, we talk a lot about that, but the National School Boards Association sends out kind of policies, model policies and stuff to school boards across the country, school counselors, National Association of Secondary School Principals, and things like that. And all of these organizations are controlled by the left. I mean, they are really dominated by progressives. So what seems to have the gloss of kind of neutral education groups supporting a particular course of action or curriculum is nothing more than outside organizations strongly dominated by progressive ideology shaping and influencing what is happening in our schools. And unfortunately, the people that public schools are least responsive to are American parents.
Yeah, well, it was kind of amazing, you know, looking what happened, say, in North Carolina with their bill that eventually ended up kind of being repealed, that sought to protect everybody's privacy. Was a broader bill than just schools. But just the people that came out of the woodwork to oppose that bill, like corporate America, you know, MBA, NCA, it's just amazing.
Right.
And it's like, how do you overcome that?
Yeah, and you raise a good point, because one of the things that is really striking is the influence that the tech community has on public schools, because they are funding a lot of initiatives, and the tech community is dominated at the top anyway by largely progressive minded companies, as we've seen with Google and Facebook and Twitter and those sorts of things. But by the same token, there are the kind of corporate groundswell of support for these agendas is something that has been manipulated. It's something that is the product of more than a decade of hard work by the left to really kind of swing corporate America into line with the agenda through sort of the carrot and the stick. You know, especially in the LGBT area, they set benchmarks. The Human Rights Campaign sets benchmarks for corporations, and they have ratcheted up the benchmarks, made them more and more, not just non-discriminatory, but more and more promoting LGBT agendas at the expense of kind of the ordinary worker, the values of, without respect for the values, particularly of religious folks who don't want to be forced to comply with this.
Right.
So that's been a project that's been ongoing. It's a strategy, really, that's been ongoing for more than a decade. And we're seeing the results of that, what looks like a spontaneous uprising of corporations saying, no, we don't want discrimination, is really a reflection of how much those corporations are in the pocket of lobbyists like the Human Rights Campaign.
Right. Well, I'm just thinking in terms of kind of the direction of education as well, being kind mm-hmm. of shifted from a classical education model to workforce mm-hmm. development. I think, you know, we're going right. to probably see more and more of that, of corporate influence into the schools. You write, basically, you know, well, you know, and we kind of touched on earlier, no president can loosen the left's grip on public education, but the problem solvers will be found not in the faceless educational bureaucracy, but in our homes, churches, and local communities. Can public schools still be reformed at the local level?
So here's what I think. I think parents need to really educate themselves, which is why we wrote Get Out Now, educate themselves about what's going on, and then look at your child and realize you don't get a do-over on childhood. You know, your child, you get one shot at forming basic things that are now being destabilized within the public school system. A child's sense of whether they're male or female, their understanding of who they are, their belief in God. If you're a family that is religious, that's being completely undermined by not just secularism in the public schools, but really a hostility and an intentional fencing God out of all the important questions, and even religion out of all the important questions of life, of history, of science, and all those things. So this is, it's having an impact on our children now. And so the question is, what do I need to do for my child now? It doesn't mean we give up on the public schools in the long run. Mm-hmm. But right now, legislators aren't listening to parents. They will support kind of very stingy voucher programs because they're afraid of the unions and the left saying, you're not supporting public education.
Right.
And I would encourage conservatives to really ask themselves, what's the fruit of public education? We're turning out generation after generation that is increasingly just left-wing, politically left-wing. You know, the most recent class of high school graduates is the most liberal since the 60s and early 70s. And that's by design. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not accidental. They're less loyal to America. They identify less as Americans with a pride in who we are as a country in spite of the flaws, you know, and the historical errors. But we're a great country, but that's not what our kids are being taught. And so we really have to look and say, are we getting what we're paying for here?
Right. There's several things you mentioned there I want to address. I have to circle back to a couple things. But first thing with vouchers, is just with how some voucher programs are set up. For instance, mm-hmm. I look at Indiana's voucher program, had strings attached. It was mm-hmm. probably one of the primary reasons that Common Core ended up coming into the Catholic schools in that state. Is there a way to do school choice that doesn't involve strings attached?
Honestly, I think we need to embolden our legislators and really make this kind of a do or die thing to recognize that parents as the taxpayers have a right to have the money follow the child, not to have the form of education dictated by the state. And we need to just be cut and dried about that, whether your child is wealthy mm-hmm. or whether your family is wealthy, whether they're poor, whether they're middle class, the amount of money spent per child in the public school system is, you know, off the charts. So even if you only took a portion of that, if the vouchers allowed, let's say, 2/3 of that amount to follow the child, so you're still giving the public school system, you know, 1/3 of the cost per child so they can keep the school buildings up and all that stuff. Even if you gave parents 2/3 of that amount, parents would spend it far more wisely. And they would get the educational result for their kids that they want, whether it's homeschooling, tutors, co-ops, private school, online education. There are so many alternatives. And what? So it makes no sense for the government to have this tight-fisted grip on every tax dollar to ensure that every child has a cookie-cutter education.
Well, what you're describing is vouchers. I would actually call education savings accounts. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Right. In some states, yes, that's the way it's.
Vouchers, in my mind, is typically direct state to school payments, where mm-hmm. education savings accounts are, you know, money that, yeah, like I said, follows the child. They put in an account, and then there's a whole cafeteria mm-hmm. of items that a parent can choose from in order to, you know, to use that account to spend from that account on their child's education. Mm-hmm. Not that I want to get bogged down in a school choice discussion, but you also said
something. And I think, honestly, maybe we ought to just, you know, create new terminology, because things like vouchers and even educational savings accounts, those have been demonized by the left, and there's so much baggage associated with those terms that everything gets muddy because they can mean different things in different places. I almost think we need to come up with a new word to express what it is that we're saying here, and that we can get legislators behind and realize this actually helps people in the minority communities and the underprivileged areas. It helps them far more than the existing situation.
Now, you'd said something earlier about, you have limited time with your child. And I remember when my wife and I were talking about homeschooling, I was a youth pastor at the time. Mm-hmm. And I had this mentality that, hey, you know, our kids should be salt and light in the mm-hmm. public schools, and we can't abandon the public schools. And you touched on some of that, but what would you say to a parent who says, you know, I want my child to be a witness for Christ in public school, so I don't I want to leave them there.
So here's the problem. In reality, it's not working.
Okay.
So when you look at the statistics of kids coming out of public schools, they are losing their faith at incredible numbers. And this is a problem across denominations. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly we see it. I'm Catholic by background. And when we look at the numbers, there's a research organization, CARA, that did the numbers on millennials who had gone to public high school versus a Catholic school. Only 5% of millennials who had attended a public high school still worshiped weekly, compared to close to 40% of people who had attended a Catholic school, which, you know, 40% should be way higher.
Right.
But it's striking. If you said to parents, you know, Catholics in particular here, mm-hmm. your child, there's only a 5% chance or likelihood that they are going to come out and be a practicing Catholic. That ought to scare the daylights out of parents, if that's really important to parents. Right. You know, in other words, are we fooling ourselves that, yes, our kids are being salt and light, when in reality, they're being worn down? And we're placing, I think, especially with younger children, or even in those middle school and teen years when peer pressure is so important or is so heavy, are we placing an unreasonable burden on them?
Right.
Because they're like the lone child facing the tsunami that's coming at them from authority figures, from the school culture, from their peers, that's just washing over them. And we're expecting them to, you know, to stand firm. And there will be the kind of rare kid or the unusual kid who is going to hold fast and who's going to be a fighter. But the vast majority of kids, this is just overwhelming them. And it's like an undertow, just taking them out to sea. And so as parents who believe in God, I think we need to really look honestly at what the impact is. And the numbers don't lie. It is not a pretty picture.
Right.
So, you know, I think, again, we get one chance to do it right. Our kids will have so many chances to be salt and light, whether it's on the sports teams, whether it's in, you know, other extracurricular groups, and certainly by the time they go to college. But what we're seeing is by the time they go to college, they've already lost their faith.
Right, right. So you also talked about kids. Well, let's see. They're they're not being taught the same thing about civic life that you and I probably experienced when we were in high school and in public school. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you went to public school. I did. I am a public school product. But one thing I noticed, there was a recent survey, I think Education Week did it, of several administrators and a number of administrators specifically about civic education. And it struck me that a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality of administrators thought that the most important thing with civics education was teaching kids to, you know, become civically engaged and not the Constitution.
Right.
Like, wow. One of the things I've noticed a lot with education is they talk a lot about getting kids, whether it's Common Core, getting kids to think critically or becoming, or with civic life, getting to be engaged in civic life. But there's a lot of push to action without a whole lot of content bolstering that. So go ahead.
No, what I was going to say is I think you're exactly right. And what happens is they create an excitement and a disposition in the kids that to be a good citizen, what that means is being an activist. And our kids are like empty vessels. And so they're convinced I'm going to be an activist. Well, then who sets the agenda? What are you going to be an activist about? If we look at what's being fed to them in the public schools, the projects, the opportunities are driven by the left. So it's activism to promote climate change, activism to do other things that are more left wing. In other words, our kids are in danger of identifying kind of civic involvement with supporting a progressive agenda. And then fundamentally underneath, they know nothing about the structure of American government, about the tremendous rights and privileges we have as citizens. So they're frankly very easily manipulated and without having that substance to really become critical thinkers, because they've got something that of foundation to measure things against. They're not given that foundation.
Right. There are a number of things you wrote about in this, but you guys touch on social emotional learning, which is kind of a hot button with education fads. And of course, we could go deeper on the whole, how kids are losing their religion in public schools. But I want to end our time just kind of talking, kind of helping the, you know, rubber meet the road here. First of all, what can parents do prior to getting out of public school? What can they do to protect their kids at this moment?
Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, educate yourself. You know, read our book and realize what the landscape is, and so that you're aware. No matter how good your teacher is, no matter how good your principal is, they wear a straitjacket that really is imposed by the educational establishment. They might be sitting next to you in church one day, the next day they're affirming gender identity and the fact that gender is a spectrum and nobody's really male or female, because that's what they have to do in school. And so educate yourself about what is happening, first of all. And then second, you've got to engage these topics with your own kids. And again, this is where the education comes in. You have to know what your kids are hearing, because your kids aren't necessarily going to come home and volunteer that, hey, we learned that gender is on a spectrum and there's really no male or female. And you need to know that, but then you need to figure out and have the words to counter that, and then to plug them into a peer group that is like-minded. Because one of the things that we're seeing is that, especially in the area of religion, that within the public schools is the number of nuns, N-O-N-E-S, increases, you increasingly have a significant portion of kids in the public school who are growing up with no experience of religion, no experience of faith. And so for that rare kid who's the salt and light, maybe they're going to have a good influence. But for most kids, that erodes their own identification as someone who believes in God and who orients their life about that. So it's educating yourselves, parents, raising these topics with your kids. But then, frankly, I would say you need to, if you're a believer, you need to be talking to your pastor, and you need to say, what are we doing to counter these messages that our kids are hearing? Our kids need to hear the truth from their parents, but they need to hear it from others as well.
Yeah,
other authority figures, from peers. Yep. And so, you know, all those things are things you can do. But I guess the final note might be just for parents to really to pray, to think hard, and to look at your child and realize you get one shot. You can put them in remedial English. You can put them in remedial chemistry, you know, and get tutors or something like that on the outside. You don't get a do-over on their sense of who they are, their fundamental character, their identification of what it means to be an American. I mean, all those things are much more fundamental to who our kids are and what we as parents want for them. And so that's the thing to keep your eye on, because there's a cost to all kinds of education.
Right.
Might be money if you send them to a private school, might be time if you're homeschooling, but there's a cost to public education, and we tend to think of it as free, but that cost is very personal and direct.
Right.
And that's what we need to focus on.
So, and that's, I think, a good place to end. Just, yeah, my wife and I, we made, you know, be 15 years ago at this, by now, to say, hey, you know, we are going to make the sacrifice. I was on a youth pastor's salary.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, it's not like we were rolling in money. We knew private school wasn't an option. So that's why homeschooling, you know, ended up being at the top of our list. So yeah, there's a cost, and parents need to decide. They need to make some hard decisions. What can we do right now if there's not a school choice program in your state that can help you financially to make this happen? It's going to require sacrifice. So
But that's what love is, right?
Right.
Love is sacrifice.
Right. Well, hey, Mary, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. This is very helpful, and your book was a poignant reminder of the stakes involved with our kids in public schools. So I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Shane.
Hey, very welcome. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure you go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's CAFFEINATED thoughts.com, or Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our emails so you don't miss a single article on our website. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Be sure to give us 5 stars if you subscribe to iTunes. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also find us on Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and you can listen using your favorite podcast app. Until next time, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.